Welcome to the CancerCare Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from a panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messer, Director of Education and Training at CancerCare. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Candace, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect Education Workshop, and this is part one of a three-part series. So the series is called Highlights from the 39th Annual San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, or SABCS, and today's program is titled The Latest Developments Reported at the 39th Annual San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. And there are many of you on the call today, and this is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations and breast cancer-specific organizations. And really, it's because of that collaboration that we have so many of you on the call today. We have over 972 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, Serbia, Sweden, and the United Kingdom. So it's a bit of a global call as well, and it's really a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us to learn more about the treatment of breast cancer and really what's new from this major conference that we've just, that our speakers have really recently attended. Now, today's activity is supported by AbbVie, the Celgene Corporation, a contribution from Lilly, Novartis Oncology, and Pfizer. And I really want to thank them for their support of this entire series, and not just today's program, but this three-part series, and also for their corporate partnership in making this possible. Now, we have the very best speakers on our call today. I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Jen Rosa Bronner. Dr. Bronner is Medical Director, MD Anderson Cancer Center at Cooper, Division Head, Hematology and Medical Oncology, the Cooper Health System, Professor of Medicine, Cooper Medical School at Rowan University. And Dr. Bronner is going to present to you the purpose of the 39th San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. She's going to give you selected highlights of research findings presented at SABCS and new research reported for the treatment of early-stage breast cancer and updates on the treatment of HER2-positive breast cancer. And it's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Bronner.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be here. First, let's talk about the meeting itself, the 39th San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. It's a very exciting meeting for everyone who attends. The purpose of the meeting is really to focus on basic research as well as clinical research, with attention being on prevention, screening, genetics, treatment of early stage, as well as metastatic disease. This meeting started in 1977 and has become a true international symposium with representatives from over 90 countries and very diverse people attending, medical oncologists, radiation oncologists, surgeons in breast cancer, nursing, behavioral health, and an ever-increasing number of patient advocates and patients. It's a joint effort between the American Association of Cancer Research, the Cancer Therapy and Research Center at the University of Texas Health Sciences Center in San Antonio, and Baylor College of Medicine. So it's really a three-group effort that leads to a phenomenally excellent meeting. Having said that, I'm going to present a little bit on early-stage breast cancer, focusing on hormonal therapy. Remember that this is a three-part series, so some of the things I'll be touching on, you'll hear more as the other two series come on board. In early-stage breast cancer, I thought one of the most interesting things we heard about and that were anxiously awaited were studies looking at the duration of hormone therapy in early-stage breast cancer. Women that have hormone receptor-positive disease, which is a large proportion of breast cancer. What's the standard of care for this population? It has been one of three approaches. Tamoxifen for 5 years, followed by maybe tamoxifen for five more if the woman is premenopausal. Tamoxifen for 5 years, followed by an aromatase inhibitor for 5 years if she's postmenopausal. Tamoxifen for 2 to 3 years, followed by an aromatase inhibitor for 2 to 3 years, or simply 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor. So those have been the choices that oncologists and patients have made, and the choice very much depends on the woman's menopausal status, the stage of her disease and how aggressive her disease is, et cetera. But as more use of aromatase inhibitor therapy is done in postmenopausal women, the question remains about how long and whether there's benefit to extend aromatase inhibitor therapy. Is there a benefit for 7.5 years of aromatase inhibitors versus 10? Because we know that, unfortunately, women still recur after the first 5 years of aromatase inhibitor therapy. So risk continues to be significant at 10 years and even some at 15 and 20 years. So 3 trials were done to help answer this question, and I'm going to walk you through a little bit of the data. The first trial was called the DATA trial. It compared 3 versus 6 years of anastrozole or arimidex after women had completed 2 to 3 years of tamoxifen. These were postmenopausal women, 2 to 3 years of tamoxifen followed by the aromatase inhibitor. So in total, they either got 5 years of hormonal therapy or 8 years of hormonal therapy. I think a very important question. 1,900 patients were enrolled in this Dutch trial, and they looked at disease-free survival, and there was a suggestion of benefit. There was a suggestion, but it was not statistically significant. So there was some benefit. The benefit seemed to occur in higher-risk patients, patients that were estrogen and progesterone positive rather than just estrogen receptor positive, women that were HER2 negative, women that had gotten chemotherapy as part of their early treatment, and also women that were node positive. The authors of this study concluded that one should not extend therapy in all patients, that the benefit was in select high-risk patients. And what they saw in this study is something that we saw in the other 2 studies as well. Adverse events or adverse side effects were what we expected. Arthritic symptoms, musculoskeletal symptoms, fractures, osteopenia, and osteoporosis. So the first of the 3 studies and a large study suggested that if there is some benefit, it's not enormously high and there are side effects that have to be kept in mind, but it may be appropriate for some. The second trial was called the IDEAL trial, and that trial asked the question 7.5 years versus 10. And in that trial, disease-free survival and overall survival was not different, even when they looked at different subgroups within the study. What they did see was that second cancers in the opposite breast were decreased. They also confirmed the adverse events, the side effects. They confirmed that women got arthralgias, osteoporosis, hot flashes. And they showed something that is also important, compliance. Women taking their drug for the full duration was poor. At 5 years, meaning as these women were completing their 10 years of study, only 55% of the patients were continuing on their drug, and they stopped largely because of toxicity. So in this second study, they found no benefit of extended endocrine therapy beyond the 7.5 years, which is where the study began. And finally, the third study was an American study, NSABP B42. I hope your oncologists have talked to you about this study, because when I talk to my patients, I'm always telling them I'm waiting for B42 to have results. Well, we got results. This study looked at 5 years of letrozole in women who were completing 5 years of a prior aromatase inhibitor. So women either just got their first 5 years or they got 10 years. And the study was large, 3,900-plus patients done in the United States. 62% of the patients completed the 5-year endpoint. So, again, compliance is poor because of side effects. There was some benefit for continuation, but it just missed statistical significance. So, again, the feeling from the study is that there is improvement. There's improvement in distant recurrence. There's improvement in new breast cancer events. But the conclusion of the authors was that it shouldn't be blanketly done. It should be based on patient's risk and a discussion looking at toxicity. The 3 trials were discussed together by Professor Knapp, and he basically concluded that one should do risk assessment with each patient. Decide where the risk is high enough to continue drug and where the benefit warrants it. Where the woman may be tolerating her hormone very well, you might continue. Her bone health is good, you might continue. She's higher risk, you might continue, whereas other patients may not be continued based on that. So the conclusion from these three studies was that, again, it is not one answer for all women, but it needs to be individualized, and it should be a discussion with your oncologist. So the second trial that I just want to mention is a different question, and that's the question of chemotherapy. There's been a lot of debate about what is the perfect chemotherapy, and in the United States, people use adriamycin, Cytoxan, Taxol is a commonly used one. In Europe, it's Epirubicin, Cytoxan, and Taxol. And in this one study called the REED trial, they compared 6 cycles of docetaxel or taxotere plus Cytoxan to this other regimen of Epirubicin, Cytoxan, and Taxol. And the conclusion was that the results were quite similar. There was not a significant benefit favoring one or the other. So I think it is an option, and if a physician wants to avoid the anthracycline or the adriamycin, it is possible to do that. There were some patients that might benefit a little bit more from the adriamycin, but it does raise the option of other regimens. Let me move to HER2-positive disease. And in the HER2-positive population, the first study I want to talk about is a trial that was done in women with metastatic breast cancer that is HER2-positive. It's a trial called the PERTAIN trial. And many women are currently being treated with pertuzumab in combination with trastuzumab and chemotherapy. And what the study was asking is, in this particular combination, can you give women the combination with an aromatase inhibitor, and how does that compare with just Herceptin or trastuzumab with the aromatase inhibitor? So how does the doublet, dual inhibition of the HER2 pathway with an aromatase inhibitor, compare to just using Herceptin? Now, the caveat, though, is that in this study, women were allowed to receive chemotherapy with pertuzumab and trastuzumab for 6 cycles prior to then going on the hormonal arm, and quite a number of women did. But the focus of the study was just looking on the outcome for these women once they began their hormonal therapy. So what the study showed was that this was a very nice combination. The objective responses that were seen and the duration of these responses was better for the combination of the three arms versus just Herceptin and the aromatase inhibitor. Duration of response was almost doubled with the combination. But what the study also showed was that discontinuation or interruption of pertuzumab was seen in a number of patients, because it's a combination, pertuzumab plus trastuzumab gives you side effects that include diarrhea and other GI toxicity much more often than when you just use the Herceptin and the aromatase inhibitor alone. So again, I think the results highlight that if you have a woman who has metastatic breast cancer, who is an appropriate candidate for, again, this combination, the results were good. And many women will actually have a very, very nice responses that can continue long term. The other study that I want to highlight is a study that is applicable only for women that are getting chemotherapy prior to surgery. And it was a trial done in the United States, NSABP B52, and it was a study that takes women and gives them taxotere, carboplatin, Herceptin, and Perjeta, or pertuzumab, and it asks the question, can we improve the response if we suppress estrogen versus not? And traditionally, we have not done that. Traditionally, women get chemotherapy, and then once the chemotherapy ends, we then move on to think about hormonal therapy approaches. So the question that this trial was asking is, how much benefit do you get from doing this combined approach of suppressing the HER2 pathway as well as the estrogen receptor pathway? So this was, if a woman was postmenopausal, she basically got taxotere, carboplatin, Herceptin, Perjeta with an aromatase inhibitor. If she was premenopausal, she got the same thing, but her ovaries were suppressed. so that she could get the aromatase inhibitor. What the study showed was that the combination was not antagonistic, so it didn't harm, it didn't increase toxicity, but there was also no significant increase in what people love to obtain, which is what is known as a pathologic complete response, meaning no cancer in the breast, no cancer in the lymph nodes at the time of surgery. That's what we're aiming for when we do preoperative chemotherapy, and we know that if we use this regimen, Taxotere, Carboplatin, Herceptin, and Perjeta, in about 40% of patients that go to surgery, you will have 40 to 50% of patients, you will have a complete pathologic response. It was not improved by adding the hormonal blockade. There was, however, slightly improved rates of being able to have lumpectomy as opposed to having mastectomy. So 42% of the patients underwent lumpectomy versus 33% in the patients that didn't have the estrogen suppression. So, again, I think this was interesting. It gives us some thoughts for the future, but the outcome was not significant in terms of improving the odds. Now, there were several other studies that I'm not going to talk about because I don't have time that looked at predicting response to treatment based on cancer subtypes. And hopefully in the other series that you'll hear more about PAM50 as a tool to use preoperatively in determining outcome circulating microRNA signatures as a way of predicting response. So there is a lot more that we're going to be using in the future to predict how well a woman is going to do with preoperative chemotherapy, but this is just the beginning. So I'll stop there and answer your questions at the end.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Garner. That was really wonderful. Just a wonderful introduction to the whole call and a lot of very important information. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Shannon Pahawa. Dr. Pahawa is Director of Breast Cancer Clinical Research Program, McGee Women's Hospital of UPSC, Women's Cancer Center, Assistant Professor of Medicine, Department of Medicine, University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. And Dr. Kohala is going to address precision medicine's increasing role in the treatment of breast cancer, genomics, and ER and PR positive breast cancer, updates from SABCS for the treatment of triple negative breast cancer, and follow-up care. So now it's my pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Kohala.
Carolyn, thank you very much for the introduction, and I'm really excited to speak with this audience again. So kind of a big task to cover in 11 minutes, and if I go over, please bring out the cane. But ultimately, the studies that I'm talking about with you today are those studies that fall into this idea of precision medicine, and maybe more broadly to think about these as genomic trials. So these are studies that look at how the DNA in the tumor or the genes in the tumor predict what type of treatment may work best or allow us to understand why certain treatments may work in some patients but not in others. So with that, I'd like to start with a study that was a comprehensive comparison of prognostic signatures in breast cancer recurrence from the Trans-APAC investigators. So this is a really important study because this is a very commonly encountered patient population. So what we're going to talk about is those assays that are done on ER-positive cancers to help to determine whether or not chemotherapy may be needed. And I'm certain that many people on the call have had these assays done. So this was a study from a proportion of patients who were enrolled in a larger study called the ATAC, the ATAC trial, and this was a study that was one of the very earliest looks at the aromatase inhibitor. So compared aromatase inhibitor, anastrozole, to tamoxifen, either alone or together, and there were a number of tumor samples that were collected from patients in those studies, and those have been called the trans-ATAC, so the translational ATAC, and we'll look today at this. So what this study aimed to look at is with all of these different assays that exist. So the assays I'm talking about are things like MammaPrint, things like the Oncotype or the recurrence score, the breast cancer index, Prosigna, EndoPredict. So there's many different assays that are available and really each have maybe their own pros and cons. And the question was, if you compare them all to each other, what stood out as perhaps being those that were most accurate or most reliable? Now, I will say this is one study that has done that. Many other studies over the years have attempted to do that. What was nice about about this is that it was a large patient sample, and then also these are all patients who were treated uniformly. So basically, they sought to determine which helped to determine prognosis the best, the potential value of chemotherapy the best, or the extrapolated potential value of chemotherapy, and how to predict those patients who may recur late. So late recurrences are that patient population who recurs after year 5. So diving into this, what they looked at were something called the clinical treatment score, the IHC4, the Oncotype recurrence score, the breast cancer index, the Prosigna, you also hear that called the ROR, the risk of recurrence, and the EndoPredict, also called EPCLIN. So this was over 800 women. These are all women who either had tamoxifen or anastrozole who did not get chemotherapy, so that's an important distinction. And this is with 10 years of median follow-up. So follow these women for 10 years after they were randomized to one of those hormonal treatments and saw what happened. Now, in this study, the majority of the patients, over 500, were lymph node negative. Just over 200 were lymph node positive, and those women who were lymph node positive tended to be older and tended to have larger tumors. So the first thing that they looked at was the prognostic value, meaning that if this test said that you were low risk, were you certainly low risk, meaning that you did not have the cancer come back somewhere else later. So all six of these assays that I just mentioned provided good information to predict distant recurrence. And all of them provided additional information beyond what's just normally on the PATH report. So just beyond the estrogen, the progesterone, the node, the grade, et cetera, these all added to that. So that was important because that's how we've been using these assays now for the past 10 years. Now, when they looked at the prognostic value, which again was were those patients who were said to be low risk, truly low risk, they found that the two assays that appeared to perform the best were the BCI test and the risk of recurrence test, and those were strongest in patients who were lymph node negative. Now, in the lymph node positive patients, the data was a little bit weaker overall, except the CTS score and the EPCLIN, the EndoPredict, and particularly the EndoPredict, seemed to have the strongest prognostic value in the node positive population. So again, in the node negative, these commercially available assays, so the commercially available are the breast cancer index, the BCI, the Oncotype recurrence score, the risk of recurrence, or the Prosigna, and the EPCLIN or the EndoPredict. All four of those provided significant information and good risk stratification. And all four of them, if they categorized a patient as low risk at 10 years, those patients were truly low risk, meaning that their risk of recurrence was quite low compared to those who were categorized as high risk. In the node positive population, again, the risk of recurrence score and the EPCLIN provided good discrimination between those risk groups, but perhaps the other ones were slightly less clear, meaning that somebody who was designated as low risk was not always low risk. So the next question that this study looked at was, well, what happened in those late recurrences? So what happened in years 5 to 10? Did those studies still hold up, or did those assays still hold up? And what they found is that if patients were lymph node negative, that the IHC4 and the Oncotype appeared to not provide as much prognostic information in terms of late recurrence, whereas the BCI, the risk of recurrence, and the EPCLIN did. And in those patients who were lymph node positive at years 5 through 10, the CTS and the EPCLIN provided the greatest information. And then looking again at risk of recurrence later, that the risk of recurrence score, the Prosigna, showed good risk discrimination, meaning that you could clearly identify a low-risk population that was clearly different from a high-risk population, but these were the patients who were of lowest risk. So a couple conclusions from this. I don't think that this is a study that necessarily says that that these other assays that you may have had or that we've used in the past aren't reliable or aren't good. I think it's something that helps us to think about when you're going to choose one assay, which I think in the future insurance companies are more and more in favor of. This is something where we might say, okay, which one will we choose? Now, with that, again, there's other studies that have shown these other assays to all be good as well. The other thing to keep in mind is that this was only good information in those patients who did not receive chemotherapy. So really what we hope to identify is those women who truly have a low risk score, who truly don't need chemotherapy, and who truly over a 10-year time frame will have an excellent prognosis. So that is that study there. Now, I'd like to move forward a little bit and talk more about estrogen receptor positive or hormone receptor positive patients who have disease that has spread. So looking at those patients with ER positive metastatic disease. And what I'd like to talk to you about is an abstract that was presented by a scientist at Baylor, Suzanne Fuqua. And she is somebody who has worked on the estrogen receptor for many, many years and is really kind of a laureate in that field, so to speak. But what this study looked at are receptor or mutations that occur within the estrogen receptor. So the estrogen receptor is very important because a lot of our treatments are targeted towards hormonal effects. And when we think about patients who become less responsive to hormone therapy or resistant to hormone therapy, it's been a huge challenge in oncology trying to figure out why that happens and who that happens in. So what's really interesting about these estrogen receptor mutations, we've heard a lot of data, I'd really say, within the past 12 to 24 months regarding these. But ultimately, why these are important is that it appears that about 20 to 40% of patients who have metastatic estrogen-positive breast cancer will have a mutation in this ESR1 gene, or in this gene that encodes for the estrogen receptor. And this is important for a number of reasons, but really why it's most important is that this is a mechanism of resistance to aromatase inhibitors. So basically this leads to constant estrogen signaling despite the patient being on an aromatase inhibitor. And these are things that we feel are acquired during treatment with an aromatase inhibitor. So with that, if we cannot use an aromatase inhibitor for a patient who has an ESR mutation in their tumor, what can we use? So there was some data that was presented at our other big yearly meeting, the ASCO, or American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting, looking at a drug called fulvestrant or Faslodex. This is a very commonly used treatment for patients who have estrogen receptor positive breast cancer that has spread. And what has been shown is that fulvestrant is active. So the data that was presented at San Antonio this year by Dr. Fuqua basically looked at preclinically, can models be created in the laboratory so that we can study this better? And what she demonstrated is that medications like everolimus or afinitor, or the CDK4/6 inhibitors, drugs like palbociclib or Ibrance, or drugs like pictilocid, these are agents that we will frequently give with hormone therapy to help it work better. And what was shown is that there was, in fact, synergy that was also seen in the setting of an estrogen receptor mutation. So it shows us that there are agents that we can use when this happens. The other thing that was interesting is that it appeared that if estrogen receptor mutation was present, that led to something called EMT, or epithelial mesenchymal transition, and ultimately what's important about that is that something that enhances spread or enhances further metastasis. And what was interesting about that is that we're not quite sure what to do with tamoxifen in the setting of an estrogen receptor mutation, but in the preclinical studies, in the laboratory and animal studies, the tamoxifen did appear to inhibit this EMT signature, both an ESR mutation and ESR what we call wild type, so those who had normal estrogen receptor gene present. And they also did what's called a mouse clinical trial, and you'll see this in some other studies where basically you try to predict what's going to happen in humans and the mice in a very similar way. And ultimately, it showed that if you did not have an estrogen receptor mutation, that tamoxifen was effective, that aromatase inhibitors were effective, but if you had the mutation, those drugs did not have the same activity. Although what was interesting in particular with tamoxifen is that there appeared to be a difference in the primary tumor. So in these mice, they had the tumor that was still in what's essentially the equivalent of the breast or the mammary fat pad. But in terms of the metastasis or the spread of those cancer cells, that appeared to be inhibited. So I think what's important to take home from this on a large-scale overview basis is the fact that these mutations appear to be important. These are mutations that can be picked up on assays that look at sequencing the tumor DNA, something like Foundation Medicine, or are there a number of others that are available? It's also something that can be picked up on blood tests that look at circulating tumor DNA, which some of you, if you have advanced disease, may have had as either part of a standard treatment or part of a research study. But ultimately, these mutations are important. They may predict for resistance to aromatase inhibitors and may perhaps agents like fulvestrant perhaps tamoxifen, or these other newer drugs that we have, like Ibrance, the other CDK4/6 inhibitors, may be effective. So I think this is something that we'll continue to hear more and more about, particularly because it appears to be such a common mechanism of resistance in those patients who have cancer that has spread. So with that being said, I'd like to transition to the triple negative disease. And I realize I'm a little bit short on time here, but I wanted to talk to you about some studies that were done looking at particularly the role of the platinum agent, so carboplatin or cisplatin, in those patients who have either triple negative disease or BRCA mutation related disease. So the first study was a study that we're really excited about. This was a study that I was involved in as well, so I'd be happy to answer any additional questions with this. But ultimately, this study looked at carboplatin, so platinum-containing chemotherapy drug, with paclitaxel, commonly used chemo drug, and to that was added a drug called veliparib. And veliparib is a type of PARP inhibitor drug. And we heard a lot about PARP inhibitors many years ago with another drug called iniparib, which ultimately ended up not working in the way that we thought it might. But since then, particularly in the ovarian cancer space, there's been a lot of studies looking at PARP inhibitors in those patients who have an inherited mutation in the BRCA gene. So what we think happens is that when the platinum agents damage the DNA, the PARP inhibitor prevents repair of that DNA damage and can enhance the response. And why this is so important in those individuals who have a BRCA mutation is their BRCA mutation essentially makes them more sensitive to both of these agents. So with that, what this study looked at was adding the PARP inhibitor to the carboplatin paclitaxel chemotherapy. And what was found in this study was that overall, the side effects were not worse if you received the PARP inhibitor. So while you had the standard chemotherapy side effects, such as low blood counts, such as neuropathy, such as fatigue, those were not worsened when the PARP inhibitor was added. The other thing that was important is that numerically there was an improvement in how well people did when they had the PARP inhibitor added to the chemotherapy. It was a little bit interesting because it wasn't statistically significant for all effects. So while it was numerically improved, not statistically improved for how long the treatment worked, but how robustly or how many responded to treatment was higher when the PARP inhibitor was added. So this was a phase 2 study. This has moved on to phase 3. Where this is important is this is probably one of the largest studies that's looked at combining PARP inhibitor with chemotherapy in the BRCA mutation group of patients. So we're excited to see this move forward. And then thinking along that same theme, the next study I'd like to present just very briefly was something called the TNT study. This was presented by Andrew Tutt. And it had actually been initially presented at San Antonio a year prior, and the question was, is does platinum agent, does carboplatin, or does docetaxel, taxotere, work better in patients who have triple negative breast cancer that has spread? So this study included both those with BRCA mutation as well as those who did not have a BRCA mutation but had triple negative disease. And what we learned the first time around is that there was no difference between those two agents in everyone. However, when you looked at just those individuals who had a BRCA mutation, the carboplatin worked much, much better. So with that being said, the question was, can we identify a group of patients who have triple negative breast cancer, who do not have a germline or inherited BRCA mutation, but may respond to platinum? So they had a pretty wide range of scientific or translational type studies that looked at could you predict, and one of these things that was postulated was something called BRCA methylation. So basically, could there have been a way that the BRCA was shut off even though there wasn't a mutation in the BRCA? And what they found, interestingly enough, is that about 20% of the patients in their study did have methylation. There was two cases where somebody had the germline BRCA mutation and methylation, but when you looked at those patients who were methylated, they actually responded better to the docetaxel or to the taxotere. So interestingly, completely opposite of what was hypothesized to be the case. So it was different in terms of those who had BRCA that was potentially shut off by methylation compared to BRCA that was shut off by a germline mutation. So in one sense, I think this was slightly disappointing because we were hoping to find a large group of patients who could respond to platinum predictably, but I think it was quite important in saying, well, we know that BRCA methylation is not one of the ways that this happens. So that was really the major take-home point from that. Now, that was in patients who had advanced disease. The same question was looked at in patients who had early stage disease. So in the I-SPY studies, those are trials that some of you on the call may have been involved with or heard about, but this was a way of looking at treatment prior to surgery, so this neoadjuvant setting. And in this I-SPY, one of the arms was the same arm that we had looked at in the metastatic setting, the platinum drug with the veliparib PARP inhibitor. And in that study, in all patients with triple negative disease, the addition of the veliparib with the platinum agent improved that pathologic complete response. And the question, again, that was being looked at is, well, why and how can we predict that? So with that being said, what this study looked at was, again, BRCA germline mutation, and again, those patients who had the BRCA mutation responded better to platinum. They also found something called a PARP-I7 signature. And this was interesting because this also did appear to predict PARP inhibitor response. So this is something that is interesting, is exciting, is not ready for prime time, but it's perhaps something that we'll hear more from later. So I'll go ahead and stop there, and I thank you for letting me go over slightly and happy to answer questions at the end.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kohauer. Very important topics and very important for our participants to hear all these details, so thank you. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, and thank you so much. Excellent. And our next presenter is Dr. Catherine Ruddy. Dr. Ruddy is consultant, associate professor of oncology, director of cancer survivorship, Department of Oncology, Mayo Clinic, College of Medicine, Mayo Clinic. And Dr. Ruddy is going to address treatment for younger and older women, how quality of life concerns impact treatment decisions, SABCS findings on adherence and persistence, and survivorship care plans and treatment summaries. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Ruddy.
Thank you so much for including me in this important conference. Certainly there are many aspects of breast cancer treatment that are tailored to a patient's age and menopausal status, and our prior two speakers have already addressed some of these. We know that young women are more likely to have more aggressive tumor biologies and higher stage disease, and so really they tend to benefit more from almost any treatment we give, including chemotherapy. And also, some treatments are more risky for older women, particularly those with other medical problems. So at San Antonio, there were a variety of studies that informed our understanding of the importance of age in prognosis and treatment of breast cancer. And one that I just want to highlight now is the positive study. This is actually an ongoing study. We didn't get results at San Antonio, but we did have an update about this important ongoing research. And this is a trial specifically for women who were diagnosed with hormonally sensitive breast cancer before they finished their desired childbearing. And on this study, they are allowed to take a break in their anti-estrogen treatment to try to conceive and carry a pregnancy. So anyone who is interested in doing this, who has been on an anti-estrogen treatment for between 18 and 30 months, can enroll at a participating center, and this will be very, very important to understanding the safety of pregnancy at this point in treatment for patients in the future. There were several studies that were focused on treatment of older patients as well. Dr. Rugo and colleagues assessed the risk of the drug palbociclib that we've already talked about a bit today in older women specifically, and found that there was no increased risk of side effects from that drug in women over age 65, so that was very encouraging. Dr. Inu and colleagues confirmed some prior findings that older women can be, at times, spared radiation after lumpectomy because many older women actually have a very low risk of recurrence with hormonally sensitive and node-negative tumors. And another group of researchers also focused specifically on the older population. Dr. Bundred and colleagues looked at patients in the UK and found that you really do need breast surgery for early-stage breast cancers to get optimal outcomes, even in the very oldest patients. So all of that, just a taste of how age does play into our treatment. Turning to quality of life and how this impacts our treatment decision-making, there were quite a few abstracts presented on the side effects of treatment and how those can impact treatment decisions. One of the important quality of life issues for breast cancer survivors is the risk of arm swelling or lymphedema related to removal of lymph nodes under the arm. And traditionally, there's been concern that giving chemotherapy infusions in the arm that's on the same side as the breast cancer surgery could actually increase the risk of swelling of that arm. So Dr. Astorian and colleagues assessed this very rigorously over time in more than 600 patients who were getting chemotherapy as curative treatment for breast cancer between 2005 and 2016. And while 12% of the patients on the study did have some lymphedema identified, some arm swelling, there was a greater than 10% increase in arm volume at some point during a two-year follow-up, they didn't find happily that there was any increase related to chemotherapy infusion. They found that the risk of lymphedema was associated with being obese or having more lymph nodes removed, but there was no increased risk with chemotherapy infusion on that arm. And so the take home here is that probably precautions against venous blood draws and infusions in the same arm as the breast cancer surgery are not evidence-based, and we probably don't need to worry as much about these as we have traditionally. Chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy is another side effect of our treatments that we do take into consideration when we make breast cancer treatment decisions. There are certain chemotherapies for breast cancer, such as the taxane drugs, paclitaxel and docetaxel, that can cause permanent damage to nerves, and that can leave some patients with numb or tingly or painful hands and feet. We know that there is a drug, duloxetine, that has been proven to treat these symptoms, but it doesn't treat them as well as we would like for many patients, and we don't yet have any agent or approach that prevents chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy, these nerve symptoms. So Suzuki and colleagues were interested in testing whether compressing the hands during chemotherapy would reduce blood flow to the point that the nerves would be spared and you would have less of these nerve damage symptoms afterwards. They enrolled participants in a surgical glove study where they were asked to wear two surgical gloves that were one size too small on their dominant hand during the receipt of a taxane called nab-paclitaxel. And then on the other hand, they didn't have any glove on. And so the investigators were able to compare the sensory symptoms in these two hands and found that there were fewer sensory and motor symptoms in the hands that wore the gloves. So this is very encouraging that we might actually have a way to prevent taxane-related nerve damage. And the caveats to the study were that it was a relatively smaller study, and it also was unblinded, so there is some concern that perhaps there may have been a placebo effect at play. I think there is certainly a future opportunity to compare this to other potential modalities for reducing blood flow to the extremities to see whether that actually will reduce nerve damage from taxanes going forward, and this is very, very encouraging. Another abstract also focused on chemotherapy-induced nerve damage. This study was actually trying to treat nerve damage that had already occurred using acupuncture. Now, we know that acupuncture is safe and tolerable in patients with cancer, and many patients do actually prefer acupuncture to medication for management of certain side effects. There have been some smaller studies that suggest that acupuncture may reduce sleep disturbance, depression, anxiety, and improve quality of life. Zhu and colleagues looked at an immediate versus a delayed acupuncture intervention for patients with stage 1 to 3 breast cancer who had received taxanes and who had a residual nerve damage from that. In the immediate intervention group, the patients received 18 sessions of acupuncture, and in the delayed, they received 9 sessions. Both of the interventions were over 8 weeks. And they did find significantly fewer nerve damage symptoms reported by the patients who got the immediate acupuncture. And this was not compared. Some studies of acupuncture have actually compared to a sham acupuncture, and I think that will be the next step for these investigators. Turning next to mouth symptoms, everolimus, which is one of the targeted treatments we are using quite a bit in treatment of metastatic breast cancer, is known to have a significant risk of mouth sores. And in the past, about 60% of patients who start on the standard 10 milligram dose of everolimus have mouth sores due to the drug. There was a study presented at San Antonio on the randomization of patients to steroid mouth wash to try to prevent these mouth sores. And actually, on this trial, all of the patients enrolled got a steroid mouth rinse. They got two different types of steroid mouth rinse, and they were asked to use it four times a day for 12 weeks over the starting with the beginning of their everolimus treatment. And interestingly, the rate of mouth sores seemed to be only about half what they would have expected based on prior experience with the approximately 60% of patients who get mouth sores. In this study, only 28% of patients actually had mouth sores. And so this is actually informing and supporting the development of a future phase 3 randomized control trial that will compare steroid mouthwash to placebo in this setting, and really encouraging that we may be able to help people feel a lot better when they're taking these medications. Dr. Grona already talked interestingly about adherence and the importance of this in all of our interpretation of endocrine therapy results. And certainly, I just want to highlight one other study related to adherence. As she mentioned, it's very, very difficult for many patients to really complete the recommended at least 5 years and sometimes 10 years of daily oral antiestrogen treatment. And this is a problem because if you don't take the medications as regularly or as long as recommended, we do know that that can increase the risk of that the breast cancer comes back for some patients. And also, very important that side effects of these drugs are a major obstacle to being able to take them as long and as regularly as recommended for many patients. So Mal and colleagues looked at 509 postmenopausal women who had started on an aromatase inhibitor within 2 years prior, and they asked participants about how much the aromatase inhibitor was causing pains and making them feel older, aging them. And they found that the perception of the patients that the aromatase inhibitor was making them feel older was a statistically significant predictor of stopping the medication early, and also depression was a significant predictor of this. So I think going forward, we need to hopefully figure out ways to help patients feel better, manage these side effects better, and also target interventions to help them persist with these treatments as long as possible. And certainly, if you are experiencing side effects from your medications, talking to your doctor about how to manage those best so that you don't need to stop the medication is the best first step for this. Next, I want to talk a bit about survivorship care plans. So a little bit of a transition to thinking about how patients do best get the information they need as treatment ends and as transitions of care do occur. A survivorship care plan is really a document that explains to a cancer survivor and to his or her clinicians and caregivers details about the diagnosis, treatments, and what to expect going forward. And this should include information about members of the care team, the treatments received, what will be done in follow-up, symptoms to watch for, and wellness recommendations. McDowell and colleagues presented data from the Share Thoughts on Breast Cancer Survey, in which they asked patients at 8 oncology sites across the Midwest about whether they had received the written treatment summary and the instructions for follow-up that are the critical components of a survivorship care plan. They found that participants who reported that they had received both of those elements were more likely to report excellent or very good quality of care and to report that they always knew who to ask about their cancer treatments and information. So that really was only 42% of the patients who reported that they had received both elements, and certainly identifies an area for improvement in terms of an opportunity that we can try to get survivorship care plans available for more of our patients. In summary, breast cancer treatment decisions should take a patient's individual characteristics, including age and menopausal status, into consideration. We know that the impact of a given treatment on quality of life is important, and we have ongoing research aiming to minimize side effects and optimize quality of life during and after a variety of treatments. And survivorship care plans may be potentially valuable for helping patients understand what to expect in the follow-up period and how to manage the side effects and symptoms of their treatment. And I'll stop there.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ruddy. That was really wonderful and excellent and very, very informative and really addressing issues of really survivorship issues and questions that people have about their quality of life. So thank you so much. And our next speaker, is Stacey Lewis. Ms. Lewis is an oncology social worker, and she's the Women's Cancers Program Coordinator here at Cancer Care. And Ms. Lewis is going to be addressing getting your psychosocial care needs addressed during and after breast cancer treatment and how support groups may help. It's now my pleasure to turn this program over to Ms. Lewis.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and I'm also very happy to be a part of this program today after getting to participate in SABCS. So now that we've heard about the important research and medical updates coming out of the meeting, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the importance of creating a support system and how cancer care can be a part of that. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Our programs include individual counseling, which we offer face-to-face in the New York area, as well as over the telephone nationally, support groups, educational programs, practical help, assistance navigating the healthcare system, as well as some limited financial assistance. And all of our services are completely free of charge and provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person as well as his or her family and friends. We are also trained to help cancer patients and their support systems tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, physical changes, social adjustment, and the psychological impact. Adjusting to and finding ways of coping with your diagnosis in all of these areas are an important part of the healing process. As you may know, cancer affects the whole person and their entire family. Asking for help, whether you are a patient, caregiver, or loved one, is a sign of strength. You do not have to walk this path alone. Joining a support group can be a way to connect with others who've gone through similar situations and are experiencing similar issues. Individual counseling can provide a space that is just yours to voice any concerns that you have and navigate any of the issues I mentioned earlier. And these connections can help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer and their support systems experience. And feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with your diagnosis and treatment. I also wanted to mention that at this time, Cancer Care is recruiting for our next cycle of our online support groups for people with breast cancer. We have groups for stages 1-3, as well as separate dedicated groups for people with metastatic breast cancer and triple-negative breast cancer. We also provide patient and caregiver groups face-to-face in the New York area and on the phone nationally. If you're interested in any of Cancer Care services, please call our Hope Line at 1-800-813-4673, or you can visit our website at www.cancercare.org. On our website, you can find more information about all of our programs, as well as your diagnosis, treatment, and ways of coping. You can also use our website to register for those support groups that I just mentioned, as well as future groups and online workshops. We've learned a lot from today's program, and it is certainly a lot of information to digest. Our social workers here can help you understand what the information may mean for you and your loved ones. If you have any questions about today's workshops or any of the services that I mentioned, please feel free to get in contact with us. And lastly, please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care Services are here to help. Thank you so much for your attention, and Dr. Messner for the opportunity to speak today.
Well, thank you so much, Ms. Lewis. That was excellent. And we now do have time for questions. I'm going to ask Candace to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Candace will explain to you how to queue up for questions. And then if you don't get to your questions, because, of course, there are so many of you on the call today, I will explain to you before we end the call today how to get your questions answered. And Candace?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking ask a question. And our first question comes from Stephanie Kay. Your line is now open.
Thank you so much. Excellent seminar again, Carolyn. Thank you so much, Dr. Vesta. My question is for Dr. Ruddy. I'm a 10-year breast cancer survivor. I have 24 lymph nodes removed. I do have lymphedema, and I have peripheral neuropathy. I'd like to know about the studies, if anything is being done with alpha lipoic acid for peripheral neuropathy, also selenium for lymphedema, and cold low-level laser therapy that I've been taking. It's 3B It's a laser, and it's just not peripheral neuropathy and still lymphedema for both.
Thank you, Stephanie. Thanks so much for your question. And Dr. Ruddy, would you like to address that question in a general way? And so that will help both Stephanie and others on the call as well.
Yes. Well, there are a variety of different agents and approaches that are currently under study in this setting. None of the approaches that you've mentioned have been definitively proven to work in this setting, but that doesn't mean that we won't have data at some point to support them. Another approach that we're actively investigating here is a technique called Scrambler, which actually provides electronic stimulus to the nerves that are damaged and helps, we think, to potentially rewire the interpretation of the brain of the painful signals coming from the hands or feet. So definitely there's a lot of interest in this area. It's a very, very important problem and a problem that affects a lot of people. And hopefully as in the coming years, we will make more progress in terms of our ability to treat it effectively.
Thank you. And we have a question from one of our online participants. I'm going to direct this question to Dr. Grana. How often should a breast cancer survivor have a breast MRI? Is this a useful and accurate test?
I think that's an interesting question. So there are some women that should have yearly MRI of the breast, and that's typically the woman who has a BRCA1, BRCA2, a PALB2 or CHECK mutation. And in those cases, women are encouraged to have mammography and MRI every year, whether they are cancer-free or whether they have had cancer. The role of MRI in the cancer patient who does not carry a mutation, however, is much more problematic, and no recommendations really exist. And by and large, many insurance companies will not cover routine MRIs on a yearly basis just for screening if there is nothing else that warrants that heightened surveillance, no mutation, for example. So in those cases, if there's any suspicious findings, if there are any concerning issues, yes, otherwise rely on mammography.
So could you also comment on the role of just other in addition to mammography?
I tend to use ultrasound as an adjunct if there is something about the mammography that is vague. But I don't routinely order ultrasound on a yearly basis in addition to mammography. I rely on mammography, physical exam, and then use MRI or ultrasound as adjunct if needed.
Thank you. And another question from one of our online participants, and I'm going to give that question to Dr. Pahala. Is there any research indicating that if one is breast cancer-free for over 17 years, it will not recur? So that's a difficult question to answer. So Dr. Pahala, if you could address that in a general way, and of course we recommend our college who, of course, a doctor could be tough Christine as well.
Sure. So that's an excellent question. And I think that, what we have learned, and this was some data that was presented at ASCO this past year, is that in the estrogen-positive patient population, so the ER-PR-positive or ER-positive patients, the risk of recurrence does persist over time. So while I wish I could say that at 17 years somebody would never have a recurrence, I say this to my patients all the time, we never say never. Now, conversely, in patients who have had triple negative breast cancer, there's an early risk of reoccurrence in those patients that then significantly reduces over time. So again, while we never say never, we're more worried about late recurrence in the estrogen positive patient population and less worried in the estrogen negative. Now, as Carolyn mentioned, this is very individualized from a patient-to-patient basis based on a number of factors such as size, lymph node involvement, what type of treatment you had, those types of things. On an individual basis, can make a risk of reoccurrence more or less likely over time.
Excellent, and thank you, Rebecca. That's helpful. We have Dr. Grana. I think you've addressed this, but I'm going to ask. It's like a late-breaking question here, so I'm going to. Although you've identified this, would MRIs be recommended for BRCA plus if after bilateral mastectomy?
No, actually. That is a population where once you've had bilateral mastectomies, no further imaging is recommended. There is a recommendation that's out there that if you have silicone implants, the FDA has a statement that says that you should get a non-contrast MRI about 3 years after the implants are put in and every 2 years thereafter to make sure the capsule, the silicone capsule, is intact and that there's no impending rupture. I must say that I often have trouble getting those approved by insurance, despite the fact that it is an FDA recommendation, but only for assessment of the implant and capsule rather than to look for recurrence of cancer. So I don't do any imaging other than physical exam for a woman who's had bilateral mastectomies. And if she had tissue reconstruction, then you don't even need to do the MRI in those women at all.
Thank you. And there's one last question we're going to take, and then I will, of course, thank our speakers, and then I will explain to all of you how to get your questions answered that you may still have. But this one, I'm going to give it to all of our speakers. I'll have Dr. Brown start, but it's an important one to conclude a program like this. And what can I do about managing pain that is interfering with my ability to enjoy my normal daily activities? So we can say pain, side effects, fatigue, I guess we can generalize that, but just to give people just an idea of that. That's an important question.
Very much so. So I would say that the first thing is to be open with your team, whether it's your medical oncologist or your medical oncology nurse practitioner or surgeon whom you happen to be seeing. Let them know that this is an issue that is affecting you, because they will only be able to address it if they know it's existing. Many services are available to patients depending on the symptom. Many institutions have what are known as palliative care teams. Some people call them pain management teams, although I think palliative care is more than pain. It often includes other symptoms such as neuropathy, fatigue, many other symptoms fall under their bucket, and I often use them as a resource for my patients who are either having side effects from their treatment or side effects from their disease. So my first message is be open and discuss it with your team and then seek resources.
Thank you. And Dr. Profaller, did you want to add to that?
I completely agree with the previous speaker. I think it's important to note that there are some things that are out there. I think it's important that it's actually so important that there's folks who build their entire careers off what we call survivorship care, which is taking care of somebody after the diagnosis of breast cancer and after the active treatment. So I know that our site and the sites of the other speakers have these survivorship programs where you can connect with doctors who are specifically interested in the research of patients after diagnosis. So absolutely, palliative care physicians to help with symptom management, and then also seeking out those folks who are survivorship experts, if you will, in those patients who are struggling after diagnosis with lingering side effects.
Right here, our next speaker, Dr. Ruddy, who actually does that piece. Do you want to comment on that as well, Dr. Ruddy?
Well, I think Dr. Brown and Dr. Mahal have done an excellent job at responding. I don't really have anything to add, and I would just echo all that they've said.
And Ms. Lewis, do you want to add anything in terms of just the focus of some of our activities here with people in support groups and such?
Sure. Yeah, my thought that I was having when that question was posed is really that this is, a social worker, if you have a social worker, whether that's at cancer care or elsewhere, that's definitely something, that you could also bring up with them. Of course, we can't address medically the pain, but I often have conversations with people in regards to how they might go about having that discussion with their doctor. There may be some hesitation to discuss pain or, anything that they might think might be viewed negatively. But as all of the doctors have said, if you don't bring up the pain, it really can't be addressed. And there are other non-medical things that, social workers or other support staff may be able to help with, things like directing to guided imagery, working on some breathing or meditation exercises. So I think, like everything else, it can really be a team care approach, but we're definitely open to helping people think about ways that they may be able to get that addressed.
Thank you. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been all extraordinary today, so I want to thank you. I also want to thank all of our participants and all of you who've asked questions both online and on the telephone and enhanced our call today, and I hope that the answers that you received will then, of course, help you each and help others on the call listening to the responses from our expert speakers on the call today. So, in terms of just, we're about to conclude the call, but I do want to give you all information about how to get your questions that you didn't get answered yet answered. So, one thing, of course, is to start with your healthcare team. I think we say that over and over again. We all want to support each of you in bringing up those questions with the people who actually have all of your medical records, who know the most about you. It's very good to ask those questions. But also, sometimes people would like to ask another source as well, just for some general information. So, we usually refer people to the National Cancer Institute, and they can be called at 1-800-422-6237, or they also, you can actually visit their website at www.cancer.gov, and they have a live chat feature where you can actually pose a question to one of the information specialists and get answers. So that would be helpful to people both in the U.S. and internationally as well. And for those of you who like to use the telephone 800 number in the U.S. and part of Canada, would be very helpful as well. In addition, if any of you would like to take advantage of our cancer care oncology social work services, all the different programs that Ms. Lewis identified, register for also future programs that we're offering, please do contact our cancer care number, our counseling line, our hope line at 1-800-813-4673, and also you can visit our website at www.cancercare.org. And also, just to remind all of you that there is a part two to this series, and that one actually is on updates in the treatment of estrogen receptor positive, progesterone receptor positive, and HER2 positive breast cancer from the 39th Annual San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. So even more information, more details. You heard some of this initial call was really some really immediate updates for all of you, but I would recommend that program happens on Tuesday, January 31st, so next week. Some of you have registered for it already, but in case you didn't know about it, please do feel free to go ahead and register for that. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I just want to reiterate a very important point that Ms. Lewis made, that we don't want anyone on this call to feel that you're alone in coping with breast cancer, any type of cancer. We want you to know that you are part of the cancer care community, and in that respect, you are simply a phone call away or a website away from visiting us and asking for our services and help. And all those services, from practical services to having a chance to talk with one of our social workers, to a support group, to a workshop, so publications, all the different things that we offer. So please do contact us. And again, I want to thank you all, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. And look forward to your part two of those people participating in that one as well.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's workshop, and you may now disconnect. Have a great day, everyone.